We are in Genesis chapter 32. And if you remember, we're following, the focus has gone from Adam, Noah, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and we're following the life of Jacob. He has, remember, Jacob's name means supplanter, heel catcher. His character is that of a sneaky thief. He came out slightly behind his older brother Esau, who was hairy. That's what his name means, is hairy, because he was very hairy. And he came out grabbing his heel. And ever since, there's been this struggle between them. The Lord had said that the older would serve the younger, but Jacob wasn't content to let the Lord deal with that. And so he's gone his whole life trying to jockey for position. He managed to catch his brother at a time. His brother was not a spiritual man, very carnal, but caught him at a time when he was hungry and got him to trade his birthright for a bowl of soup. And then at the end of his father's life, even though his father knew that, or he thought it was the end of his life, he knew that he was supposed to pass on the blessing to the younger, because that's what the Lord had said. He still liked Esau better. So he said, "Esau, go get me some venison, make it the way I like, and then, you know, I'll give you the blessing." And so Jacob deceived his father at his mother's request, because this is a great family here. Mother says, "Hey, this is what you do. Take the lamb, I'll make the venison. You dress up in some of your brother's clothes. We'll strap on some goat hair onto your arms, because your brother apparently is as hairy as a goat. Your brother, Mr. Tumnus, he'll..." And you go in and fake out your father, because dad's blind at this point. And so you go in and lie to him about who you are and steal the blessing. And he did that. Of course, after that, his brother wanted to kill him. So he had to leave, and he took off, and he went because his parents had told him, "Whatever you do, don't marry any of the girls from around here, because they're all losers. I want you to go back to where we came from and marry from our family." So he goes back, and he runs into Laban, which is his uncle. And Laban is, you know, two peas in a pod, those two, and they proceed to cheat one another for several years. First, he falls in love with Laban's daughter, Rebekah, and works a deal with Laban to work for him for 7 years if he can marry the daughter. And he does the 7 years. Now, he's an older guy at the time. You know, he's in his 70s or so when he first meets her. And he works 7 years for her. And then they have the reception. It's at night. I'm sure that Laban got him nice and pickled and then pulled the whole, you know, Middle Eastern headdress on him, waited till it was dim, and swapped out the older daughter, Leah, for Rebecca. He wakes up in the morning and he married the wrong one. And Laban says, "Oh, didn't I tell you about that custom we have? How the old..." Because in our country, you know, we have rules about the older sibling and the younger sibling. You wouldn't know anything about that. But you marry, but for another 7 years, you can marry your sister. So he does. And then there was the whole jockeying for position with he was taking care of Laban's flocks and trying to manipulate his way into getting the major portion of them. And finally, last week, they got to the place where they parted company. In fact, he bolted out of there with his wives and all their kids and their handmaidens. I skipped the whole part where they were jockeying to have kids, and he ends up having kids with both of the women and also their servants, so that he's got 11 now, 12 if you count Dina, the girl. And he's taken off. Laban catches up with him. God had told him to get out of there. In chapter 31, verse 13, God says, "I am the God of Bethel, where you anointed the pillar, and where you vowed a vow to me. Now arise, get thee out of this land, return to the land of your kindred." Well, he does that, takes off, Laban catches him, and God warns Laban in a dream, "Don't mess with him. I don't want you to mess with him." So they build this big pile of rock, and they call it Mitzpah, and they say, "The Lord watch between you and me while we're absent one another. This heap will be a witness," verse 52, "this pillar will be a witness. I won't pass over the heap to you. You shall not pass over this heap of this pillar to me for harm." So this will be the boundary. I'll stay on this side, you stay on that side, and I don't want to see your face again. I mean, that's basically how they left it. So we come to chapter 32, following Jacob, and it starts out with two verses that I just don't understand at all. Jacob went on his way, and the angels of God met him. And when Jacob saw them, he said, "Hey, angels, cool." No, almost. I mean, he says, "This is God's host." And he called the name of that place Manahim, which means a double camp, because he set up camp and he looked around and looked, there was a bunch of angels. That's it. That's all you need to know. Just, I mean, what did that look like? You know, now he'd had that dream at Bethel a while back in chapter 28, where he saw the ladder and he saw the angels of God ascending and descending upon him. Did he recognize some from the dream? "Hey, I saw you before. Good to see you." I mean, how many were there? Was it a whole army of angels? Was it a couple angels? I don't know. It does say in Hebrews chapter 1 that angels are ministering spirits sent forth to minister for them who are the heirs of salvation. It says in Hebrews 13 that you shouldn't forget to entertain strangers because some people have actually entertained angels unaware. But other than that, we don't have much. I think the point, and God is trying to make a point with Jacob even now, although it's going to fall on pretty deaf ears, look, I'm with you. I've got your back. You know, there's that passage in Kings where the army comes to arrest Elisha, and the servant looks out, sees an army surrounding where they're at, a whole army, and he freaks out, and Elisha says, hey, don't worry about it. There's more with us than there are with them. And the guy's like, you insane? There's two of us. There's an army out there. And he prays. He says, Lord, would you open his eyes? And he opens his eyes, and he can see that on the mountain all around him, there's these flaming chariots of, you know. And I think God is just saying to Jacob, hey, I'm still in this. You have my protection, because he's worried about going back. We're going to say he's very worried because Esau's waiting for him. It's been 20 years since he's seen his brother. The last thing he did was deceive him out of the blessing of his father and then take it off because he thought he was going to die. In fact, you remember his mother said, you run, you go, you take off, and I'll send for you as soon as he calms down a little bit. It's been 20 years. Ma hasn't said a word. Ma's dead, but he didn't know that. As far as he knows, Esau's just waiting for him to cross back over the line so he can pop him. Well, Jacob sent messengers before him to Esau, his brother, into the land of Seir, the country of Edom. And he commanded them, saying, thus shall you speak to, check this out, my lord Esau, thy servant Jacob, thy lord, thy servant. He's getting all, you know, humbling himself, which is good that he's doing that. Jacob saith thus, I have sojourned with Laban and stayed there until now. I have oxen and donkeys, flocks and men servants and women servants, and I have sent to tell my lord that I may find grace in thy sight. Jacob's sending some people ahead of him. Tell Esau that I'm coming to town. Let him know that I have all kinds of stuff, so I'm not coming to steal anything else of his. I know I've ripped him off twice now and he wants to come, but let him know I got plenty. I'm not coming for anything. I've got donkeys and everything a guy would want. And the messengers returned to Jacob saying, hey, we came to your brother Esau. And guess what? He's coming to meet you. He's got 400 guys with him. Jacob's not loving this moment. Verse 7, Jacob was greatly afraid and distressed. It's funny, when he was just dealing with Laban, when Laban came after him, he was bold as a lion. Why? Because he knew that he hadn't done anything wrong. In fact, he had been wronged multiple times. His father-in-law had changed his wages 10 times, had stolen from him all this stuff. And so when he faced Laban, he wasn't afraid. He was willing to stand up because he knew that, you know, he was on right moral ground. He knows he really messed over his brother. And I think Jacob is still pretty performance-based in his relationship with God, and he's of the opinion that when I'm in the right, God's going to defend me. When I've blown it, he's going to smoke me, right? And he knows he's blown it, so he's afraid he's going to get smoked because his conscience is killing him. Was it Shakespeare, Hamlet, right? Conscience doth make cowards of us all. And he knows he's guilty. And so he immediately starts to work a plan. Jacob was greatly afraid and distressed, and he divided the people that was with him, the flocks and the herds and the camels, into two bands. And he said, if Esau come to one company and smite it, then the other company which is left shall escape. Now forget about the two camps that he just had with the angels. He ran into angels. He called the place two camps because God's angels camped with him. Now all of a sudden he's forgotten that, and now he's making his own, and he's figuring, well, at least half of us will get away. So half of you guys go over there, and I'll go over here, and knowing Jacob, I'll dress up like someone else so they won't recognize me, and we'll go in two directions. They can't kill us all, right? At least we'll save half the family. Okay, that's, I can do this. Let's see, think about this. We can do this. All right, this is the plan. We got the plan. All right, now what should I do? I know, I'll pray. I've got my plan down. I better pray about it. That's... Not that we ever do that, of course. I mean, we always pray first, right? Before we know. That's the problem with reading about this guy. I mean, you could really work up a dislike for him if he didn't look so much like me. If you didn't see yourself here in some of these things these people do. Jacob said, this is his prayer, and it's a pretty good prayer. Oh, God of my father Abraham, God of my father Isaac, you like them, like me, you like them. And the Lord which said unto me, return to your country and to your kindred, and I will deal well with you. You remember, Lord, this is what you told me to do. I'm being obedient. You told me to come back. So I'm trying to do what you say. And that's a good thing to pray. This is, Lord, what you've said. I'm being obedient to word. I'm not worthy of the least of all your mercies. He's not saying I deserve anything. He's saying, look, I need grace. And of all the truth which you showed unto your servant, for with my staff I passed over this Jordan and I've now become two bands. Deliver me, means save me. Save me, God, I pray thee, from the hand of my brother, from the hand of Esau. And he's honest here, for I fear him, lest he will come and smite me and the mother with the children. I'm afraid he's going to wipe us all out. I got 12 kids with me. Two wives, a couple concubines, 12 kids, Lord. Do it for the children. I mean, that's maybe, but I don't know. And as you said, I will surely do thee good and make thy seed as the sand of the sea, which cannot be numbered for multitude. Well, that obviously can't happen, God, if you allow my brother to kill my kids, so please. And he lodged there that same night, and he's still working the angles, you'll see. And he took of that which came into his hand a present for Esau, his brother. 200 she-goats, 20 he-goats, 200 ewes, 20 rams, 30 milch camels and their colts, 40 kine cows, 10 bulls, 20 she-donkeys, and 10 foals. And he's working two angles here. One, I'll just start giving him stuff to try to appease him, because that a lot of times works. And two, I'll let him know again, I don't want his stuff, because I know I told him I don't want his stuff, but he needs to know I have a lot of stuff, so I'm not looking to steal from you, so, you know, and I'll appease him that way. And he delivered them into the hand of his servants. Every drove by themselves, and he said unto his servants, pass over before me and put a space betwixt drove and drove. In other words, okay, let's break it up. First, we'll have all of the goats, all right? And we'll put the goats first, the she-goats. Then we'll follow 200. And then after them, we'll make a little distance. And after he encounters the she-goats, we'll follow up with the he-goats. All right, and then he'll be like, whoa, he-goats too? And then he'll go a little further, and boom, out come the camels. And he'll be like, camels? And then he'll just get through the camels, and hey, here come the cows. And it'll be just like, you know, one, like 12 days of Christmas, just one thing after another. Because he's micromanaging the details, because he still figure he's got to work the angles to keep himself from getting into trouble, because that's who Jacob is. And he commanded the foremost, verse 17, saying, when Esau, my brother, meets you, and he asks you, saying, whose are you, and where are you going, and whose are these before thee, then you shall say, make sure you say it this way, they be thy servant Jacob's, not your brother, your servant. And it's a present sent unto my lord Esau. Let him know. I'm bowing down here. Behold, he's behind us. And so commanded he the second, the third, and all that followed the drove, saying, on this manner shall you speak to Esau when you'll find him. All done is his praying, he's back to his scheming. Say ye moreover, behold, thy servant Jacob is behind us. For he said, this is his motivation, I will appease him with the present that goes before me. And afterward I'll see his face, peradventure he will accept of me. Now, if he was really having faith in God, he'd be in the front, right? He'd just go out and meet him, figuring God's going to take care of me. But no, he's sending all the gifts ahead. So went the present over before him, and himself lodged that night in the company. He sent the bribes ahead, and then he went to wait. He rose up that night, because he's still sweating it, he can't sleep, and he took his two wives and his two women servants and his 11 sons, and he passed over the ford Jabbok. And he took them, and he sent them over the brook, and he sent over all that he had. At this point, he's doing everything he can. He's pushed everybody off to the side. He's alone now. He's done his scheming, and finally the Lord gets him alone so he can deal with him. That's what happens. And that's kind of how he is with me. I don't know how it is with you, but he usually will wait until I'm done all of my thrashing and flailing and trying to do my own thing, and then he can finally get me quiet and alone. And it says, Jacob was left alone, and there wrestled a man with him until the breaking of the day. Now, and this is God, okay? He has a wrestling match. Now, you have to understand, I mean, think about this. First of all, he's scared out of his head, right? He's in the wilderness. There's no street lights. There's maybe some campfires. He's alone at this point. He's really scared. He's 90 years old. He's in the dark. And someone jumps on his back. Middle of the night. Ah! You know, he's in a fight for the life. And 90-year-old man is not giving up. He is fighting for all he's worth. And it says they're wrestling. Now, I don't know. Is this grappling? Is this a street brawl or a desert brawl? Is it, you know, I mean, is he doing the martial arts thing? Is this, there's no rules, there's no referee. This is, as far as he knows, to the death. He doesn't know who it is, but he's just fighting and scrapping and wrestling. What he's doing, and it's important to realize, okay, Jacob didn't pick this, because people will want to take this passage and say, see, so you need to wrestle with God. You need to get alone with God, and you need to wrestle in prayer until you can get him to do what you want, right? That's the wrong answer. What you want to do, and mostly I've found in my life, the wrestling in prayer comes me wrestling so that I'll do what he wants. I wrestle with me. I don't wrestle with him. I have wrestled with him in the past. I eventually lost that one. And I think everybody needs to come to the place where they have that wrestling match with God, when they resist him as many ways as they can. And finally, they realize they just can't win this fight because he's just way stronger and way more patient than we are. Jacob wrestles all night with this guy. All night. He seems to be holding his own. He's certainly not winning. And when he, this would be God, saw that he prevailed not against him, he touched the hollow of his thigh, and the hollow of Jacob's thigh was out of joint as he wrestled with him. So he's wrestling, they're wrestling, it's almost daytime, and Jacob's still scrapping, he's not giving in. And so the Lord goes, and he knocks his hip out of socket. That's not a pleasant experience, to have your hip go out of socket. The fight's basically over at that point. There's no, when a joint is dislocated and there's severe pain involved and lack of mobility in a wrestling match and you're 90 years old, you know, you fall at 90, you hurt your hip, that's kind of, you're out of the fight, right? And so, and the point is, God could have done that at any moment, any moment. He could have smoked him. He's God, after all. But he didn't. But he waits until the end of the night, and he does, he takes away from Jacob the one thing that Jacob's been holding on to, his ability to run. Because he's been running his whole life. He can't run anymore. He's going to walk with a limp for the rest of his life from this event. And then, after he does that, he, this is the Lord, says, let me go, for the day breaks. And don't get misunderstanding. It says, and he said, I will not let you go except you bless me. This is not like the scene from Monty Python with a black knight. You know, what but a scratch? Come on, you know, and he won't. This is not Jacob continuing to fight. This is Jacob clinging to him saying, please don't leave me. I need your help. He realizes who he's fighting with. And he's like, I just don't leave me. This is him clinging and begging. He says, I don't want you to go. You need to bless me. I need you to bless me. And he said unto him, this is the Lord saying to him, what's your name? Now back in chapter 27, he told his dad that his name was Esau. That's how he got the blessing. Well, you want a blessing now? Let's try this again then. Because you failed it last time this question was asked, when I had already promised that you'd get the blessing. Now we've gone through this whole journey. We've played this little game. Let me go back to it again. What's your name again? And he owns it. Because Jacob, the name means supplanter. It means, you know, scallywag. And he owns his name. He doesn't pretend he's anybody else. I'm Jacob. And he said, your name shall be called no more Jacob, but Israel. For as a prince, thou hast power with God and with men and hast prevailed. Israel, his name is changed to Israel. El being God means governed, ruled by God. Hosea gives us a little more insight into this event. In Hosea chapter 12, verse 3, it says, he took his brother by the heel in the womb, and by his strength he had power with God. Yeah, he had power over the angel, and he prevailed, and he wept, and he made supplication unto him. And he found him in Bethel, and he spake with him, even the Lord God of hosts. He's weeping, he's begging, he's pleading, and then God says, okay, it's time for a name change. Finally, hopefully, you have changed. Now, he's going to keep swapping back and forth. He's Israel one day and Jacob the next. And Jacob asked him and said, well, tell me, I pray you, your name. And he said, why are you asking after my name? And he blessed him there. You already know my name. Why are you asking now? And he blessed him. And the blessing is he was finally conquered by God. He finally gave up. And Jacob called the name of the place Peniel, for I have seen God face to face and my life is preserved. And notice this, as he passed over Penuel, the sun rose upon him, and he halted upon his thigh. He was humbled, he was unable to run, he's no longer self-sufficient, he's walking with a limp. And then it gives us this side piece of information, therefore the children of Israel eat not of the sinew which shrank, which is upon the hollow of the thigh until this day, because he touched the hollow of Jacob's thigh and the sinew that shrank. As a memorial to this is a certain part of the thigh that the Jews wouldn't eat. Because Jacob, and I like the fact that Jacob's whole life, What do they memorialize? The time when he was weakest. You know, it's kind of like what Paul said when he had that physical malady and he asked the Lord to heal him, and God said no three times. He said, my strength is sufficient for you. My strength is made perfect in weakness. And then Paul says, well, most gladly, therefore, I would rather glory in my infirmities, that the power of Christ may rest upon me. Therefore, I take pleasure in infirmities and reproaches and necessities and persecutions and distresses for Christ's sake. For when I am weak, then I am strong. And Jacob was never stronger than when he was in complete submission to God. And you and I are never stronger. Now, chapter 33, Jacob lifted up his eyes and looked, and behold, Esau's coming, and with him 400 men. And so Jacob continues to be a little Jacobish here. Like I said, he bounces back and forth. He divided the children unto Leah and unto Rachel and unto the two handmaids. He divided up the families, and he put the handmaids and their children foremost, and Leah and her children after, and Rachel and Joseph hindermost. Do you wonder why in the next few chapters the other brothers are going to hate Joseph so much? Because Dad says, well, we'll take the less desirable wives, you know, the concubines and their kids, and we'll kick them out in the front. In case he really is coming to kill somebody, maybe he'll be satisfied with them, and we'll keep the special one in the back with me. That's not going to play out well for him. He passed over before them. This was good. And he bowed himself to the ground 7 times until he came near his brother. He wasn't trying to flex that birthright thing, but he's submitting. And Esau ran to meet him and embraced him and fell on his neck and kissed him, and they wept. I like the fact that they don't need to go to counseling together for a while and work through these issues from their childhood. Because, you know, there's some stuff that we need to deal with, Esau. You and I, we need to work this stuff out. Let's go back. You remember when we were kids? Always you were grabbing me. Always you were grabbing me. Make him apologize for that. And the counselor would say, now you need to apologize. Well, what he did to me, and there's no doubt that Esau was very wronged in many places. He also did some stupid stuff, but he let it go. They let it go. And I think, you know, we've been wronged, many of us, some of us badly in our lives. People have taken advantage of us. You might have had really lousy parents, grandparents, somebody who molested you, somebody who cheated you, somebody who stole from you. The problem is when you get bitter, and it's been said that bitterness is the poison that you consume in an attempt to hurt your enemy. There's no peace in being bitter. The only peace is in letting it go and letting God deal with it. And Esau does well here. He seems to let it go. And they just move on. He lifted up his eyes. He saw the women and the children, and he said, who are those with you? You got kids? Well done, dude. And he said, the children which God has graciously given thy servant. The handmaidens came near, they and their children, they bowed themselves. Leah also with her children came near and bowed herself. After that came Joseph near and Rachel, they bowed themselves. And he said, what meanest thou by all this drove which I met? What was with all the stuff you sent me? And he said, these are to find grace in the sight of my Lord. And Esau said, I have enough. And the word he uses for enough is abundance. He said, I've got plenty. I don't need your stuff. He says, my brother, keep that you have to yourself. And Jacob says, nay, I pray thee, if now I have found grace in thy sight, then receive my present at my hand. For therefore I have seen thy face as though I have seen the face of God, and you are pleased with me. Take, I pray thee, my blessing that's brought to thee, because God has dwelt graciously with me, and because I have enough. And he uses a different word. The word that he uses for enough is, I have all things. I have everything. You can have this. I know you have plenty. I have everything, and I want you to have this. And he urged him, and he took it. And he said, hey, let us take our journey. Let us go, and I'll go before you. Esau says, come on, well, all right, we'll travel together. Let's get our caravans and we'll head on back to my place. And Jacob doesn't trust him as far as he can throw him. I mean, he loves him, he's his brother, but he's still afraid that he's going to get messed with. And he says to him in verse 13, my Lord knows the children are tender. I mean, I got these little kids. I can't go fast like you. You got 400 fast men. And the flocks and the herds with me, the herds with young are with me. And if the men should overdrive them one day, the flock will die. If we go fast, all my animals will die. I got little kids. Let my Lord, I pray thee, pass over before a servant. I'll lead on softly according as the cattle that goes before me and the children are able to endure until I come to my Lord in Mount Seir. I'll go to your place. You live in the south, Mount Seir? Okay, you go ahead. I'll be right behind you, and we'll go to Mount Seir. And Esau said, well, let me now leave some with thee of the folk that are with me. Well, I'll leave some of my men to guard you and take care of you. And he said, oh, why do I need it? Let me find grace in the sight. No, you don't need to do that. That's fine. I'll be right behind you. So Esau returned that day on his way to Seir, which is in the south. And as soon as he got over the hill, Jacob journeyed to Succoth, which is in the north. He let him get out of sight, and he went in the other direction. And this isn't a temporary thing. He builds him a house, and he makes booths for the cattle there, and the name of the place is Succoth. And, you know, it is important to note, sometimes he's going to be called Jacob, sometimes he's going to be called Israel. Normally, when he's acting like someone governed by God, he gets called Israel. When he's acting like his old self, he's called Jacob. And I think if you do the math, you'll find that he's called Jacob roughly two times as many times, twice as often as he's called Israel. He came to Shalem, the city of Shechem, which is in the land of Canaan. Because, you know, that's good. He's in the promised land. That's where he was supposed to go when he came from Paddan Aram and pitched his tent before the city. And he buys a parcel of a field. I mean, he's settling in, where he had spread his tent at the hand of the children of Hamor, Shechem's father, for 100 pieces of money. And he erected there an altar and called it Elohe Israel. The problem is, where was he told to go? Where did God meet him before? Do you remember? It was Bethel, house of God. God says, hey, get back there. That's where I met you. I'm the God of that place. You remember you played a vow to me? Get back to Bethel. Okay, I'm back in the promised land, but I'm here. I think I'll settle down here instead. I'm partially obedient, right? Or I'll get there sooner or later, so it's delayed obedience. The problem is, there's a word that sums up both partial obedience and delayed obedience. It's called disobedience. He builds an altar, but I built an altar and I named it something spiritual. That's good, right? Built an altar. He's going to learn the lesson that Saul learned in 1 Samuel 15 when Samuel says, has the Lord great delight in burnt offerings and sacrifices as in obeying the voice of the Lord? Behold, to obey is better than sacrifice, and to listen than the fat of rams. God is much more interested in you doing what he said than you doing some great thing for him. So he's in the place he's not supposed to be. And again, as we go through this last chapter, we'll go through it pretty fast. If God didn't make you write this chapter about your family, I don't know why you'd ever write it. You know, because this is just a screwed up family, okay? And they do messed up things, and it should just provoke you to realize how graceful God is. It's like that one verse where it says, Jacob I've loved and Esau I've hated. And some people get hung up on that. And it's not the fact that he hates Esau that should be the problem. It's the fact that he loved Jacob. Well, Dinah. Dinah, the daughter of Leah, which she bare unto Jacob, went out to see the daughters of the land. Hey, we're here with all of the pagan girls. I'm going to go hang with the girls from around here, okay? All the other girls are going. It'll be fine. Nothing's going to happen. And truthfully, Dad's been a dad of compromise. And if Dad has been a dad of compromise and disobedience, the kids are going to take license in that. They know Dad has no moral authority to stand and forbid them to do anything when he never does himself. And that's something you see over and over again. You get into the life of David, and all of the sins that David commits, he ends up seeing coming back to him and his family. Because who is he to say anything about someone doing something wrong when he's openly doing what's wrong? Well, Dinah decides to go hang out with the other girls of the land. The problem is, and it's important to realize this as we go through it, they're in the land of Canaan. Canaan is wicked, immorally wicked. You know, some people have a real problem when you go through the history of Israel because they come into the land of Canaan and God says, wipe them out. I want them all gone. They can't stay. You can't intermarry with them. You need to go. And some people look at that and say, boys, that's awful. Now, you have to realize a couple of things. One, he's going to say to Jacob when they go into Israel, you know what, you're going to be going to the promised land, but you're going to hang out here for about 400 years because they're not completely ripe yet. They're bad and they're going to get worse and worse, but I'm going to give them another 400 years out of grace. What they were doing is they were practicing child sacrifice. There was every immoral sexual practice, bestiality, everything you can imagine. There's historical records of whole villages being wiped out by venereal disease. It was raunchy to the core, the whole place. And he still gives them 400 years to turn things around, longer than our country has been in existence by quite a bit. But eventually he says, you got to go. You can't be a part of that. Because check out the morality of the area where Dina is going to play. Shechem, the son of Hamor, that's who they bought the piece of property that they built their house on. When Shechem, the son of Hamor the Hivite, prince of the country, saw her, he took her and he lay with her and he defiled her, which is King James for he raped her. He thought she looked pretty, so he grabbed her and he rapes her. But then his soul clave to Dina, the daughter of Jacob, and he loved the damsel, and he spake kindly unto her. And I'm sure that really meant a lot, you know. No, really, I love you. That's why I did what I did. No, you love yourself. Love is patient. Love is kind. Love doesn't seek its own. You don't love her. You love yourself, and you think that she could help you love yourself. Shechem spake to his father, verse 4, Hamor, saying, get me the damsel to wife. I want to marry that one. She's the kind of girl that I could marry. Jacob, verse 5, heard that he had defiled Dinah, his daughter. Now his sons were with his cattle in the field, and Jacob held his peace until they were come. There is a time to hold your peace, and then there's a time to lose it and go Rambo on somebody. Even the coward of the county knew, after a rape, it's time to stop and lock the door, right? I mean, that's what happens. He doesn't do anything. The boys come out of the field. He doesn't do anything. His daughter's just been raped. He doesn't do anything. Hamor, the father of Shechem, went out unto Jacob to commune with him. And the sons of the Jacob came out of the field when they heard it. And the men were grieved, and they were very wroth. They understood this just wasn't right, because they had wrought folly in Israel in lying with Jacob's daughter, which thing ought not to have been done. And Hamor communed with them, saying, I am so sorry that my son did this wicked thing. No, that's not in the text at all. He says, you know, the soul of my son Shechem longs for your daughter. I pray you give him her to wife. There's no acknowledgement of wrongdoing. Your son just raped somebody, and you're trying to make a deal to marry her. There's no apology. There's no recognition of right and wrong. What possibly would make you think that there's any way this guy would want to give his daughter that you just violated to you forever? Because again, the morality of Canaan was messed up. Not only that, not only do I want my son to marry her, but make you marriages with us. Give your daughters unto us. Take our daughters unto you. And you'll dwell with us, and the land shall be before you. Dwell and trade therein, and get you possessions. I got a great idea. How about we become relatives, and we'll all intermarry? Because this is the kind of in-laws you want. And then your grandbabies can grow up to be just like my boy. It'll be wonderful. And not only that, look at all the stuff you'll get. We can trade stuff, this stuff here. We can intermarry. It'll be wonderful. You know, there's a reason why in 2 Corinthians chapter 6, Paul says, be ye not unequally yoked together with unbelievers. For what fellowship has righteousness with unrighteousness, and what communion has light with darkness? Sometimes it happens that you have people, a couple, they don't know the Lord, one of them gets saved, and they find themselves connected to somebody who doesn't know the Lord and has no desire to know anything about the Lord. There are men and women that go to our fellowship that find themselves in that position. They've become Christians. They find themselves attached to a husband or a wife that wants nothing to do with the Lord. Have a talk with them. They'll tell you, there's no fun in that. There's no joy in that. It's a painful road, and they wouldn't wish it on anybody. If you could possibly avoid that, by all means you should. My daughters, my son, if you could possibly avoid that, by all means you should. Okay? Because it's like unequally yoked. It's like hooking up an ox and a donkey. They're not the same size. They're not the same strength. They don't pull the same way. They're going to go in two different directions. And it's going to be painful for both of them. And they're going to be fighting, and they're going to be struggling their whole life. Hamor is enticing them with possessions and stuff if they'll intermarry, which is something that God strictly would have forbidden. And Shechem said to her father and unto her brethren, let me find grace in your eyes. And what shall you say unto me? I'll give. Name your price, basically. Ask me never so much dowry and gift, and I'll give according as you say unto me. But give me the damsel to wife. Basically, you name your price for your daughters and sisters, and I'll pay it. And you know, I would say this, the enemy basically will say that to all of us. You name your price, what it'll take to sell out your kids, I'll pay it. The enemy will pay whatever it is you think is worth trading your family for, he'll pay it. And Jacob is silent. The sons of Jacob answered. Now, why is Dad silent again? There's multiple places where I think Jacob should have stepped in here and been Israel, but he did not. The sons of Jacob answered Shechem, because again, if Dad's leadership is a vacuum, vacuum is not a natural state. Something will move in to fill a vacuum. That's one of the laws of science. The boys move in to fill the dad's voided leadership. The sons of Jacob answered Shechem and Hamor, his father, deceitfully, and they said, because he had defiled Dinah, the sister, they said unto him, we cannot do this thing to give our sister to one that's uncircumcised. Because that would be a reproach to us. Remember, the symbol that was given to Abraham, passed down to Isaac, to Jacob, was that all the males would be circumcised, that the foreskin would be cut off, and it would signify that they were separate. That, you know, and we know spiritually it talks about the flesh being cut away and about, you know, set apart for God, whatnot. But that was a physical thing with them. The boys say, oh, you know, we'd like to do this, but we have this custom. It would be bad if you were to marry her and you weren't circumcised. But in this, we'll consent to you. If you will be as we be, that every male of you be circumcised, we'll give you our daughters. And we'll take your daughters to us. And we'll dwell with you and we'll become one people. But if you won't hearken to us to be circumcised, then we'll take our daughter and we'll be gone. I mean, we have this custom. It's just a sign. It doesn't mean anything. But, well, it means something. And so you need... And unfortunately, what they're doing is, one, they're treating this thing that was something from God as meaningless. And two, they were lying about it. They said, well, what it really needs to happen is if you could be circumcised. But I understand that's a lot to ask. And if you guys won't do it, we'll just be on our way. But that's the thing. That otherwise, we'd be glad to trade daughters with you. Sure, we'd love to be part of your family. I mean, you guys obviously are wonderful men. Look how you've raised your boy. We'd love to intermarry. That'd be great. And their words pleased Hamor and Shechem, Hamor's son. Now, other nations practice circumcision, usually different. It was more of a rite of passage into manhood. I mean, the Jews, it had to happen on the eighth day. Other tribes would do it, you know, when the guy hits puberty or whatever. But these fellows were not, apparently. And the young man deferred not to do the thing because he had delight in Jacob's daughter, and he was more honorable, this was the rapist, was more honorable than all the house of his father. He at least was willing to go for it right away, the honorable one. And Hamor and Shechem, his son, came to the gate of their city, and they communed with the men of the city. This, I don't know how you sell this. These guys are some talkers. They come into town and say, boys, we got a deal. Check it out. You know those fellows over there that have all that stuff? Nice-looking daughters and everything? These men are peaceable with us. Therefore, let them dwell in the land and trade therein for the land. Behold, it's large enough for them. And let us take their daughters to us for wives, and let us give them our daughters. Only herein will the men consent unto us for to dwell with us, to be one people. Every male among us has to be circumcised as they are. But then their cattle, and there's, because you know they said that fast, right? Yeah, there is one little thing we have to do, but that's just it. And then once we do that, their cattle, their substance, and every beast of theirs be ours. Only let us consent unto them, and they'll dwell with us. We can have their women, and we can have their stuff, if we just do this little thing. Not that little of a thing, I'm thinking, as an adult. But it's amazing what a man will consent to for the promise of women and stuff. So unto Hamor and unto Shechem, the son hearkened, and all that went out of the gate of his city, and every male was circumcised. And all that went out of the gate of his city. Every man, adult male, was circumcised. And don't be picturing an operating room. I just went in. You see the scar on my face. I had a little piece of skin cancer stuff they took off my face the other day. Outpatient surgery, Eastern Maine. Wonderful experience. Got in there about 7:30. They bring me into the pre-op room by about 8-ish or so. They prep me. She puts, you know, it was a little uncomfortable. She did put an IV in, you know, but I was a brave boy. And so she put that in, fine. 9 o'clock, she comes in with her magic little shot of stuff. They have the leads all hooked up to me. And they give me that shot, and then they wheel me down to the operating room. And I was conscious enough to just shift myself. I got up onto the operating table myself, and then I went to sleep. And then 35 minutes later, I woke up as they're wheeling me out of the room. And I, by 10 o'clock, well, that was like 9:35. They take me to recovery. I get dressed. I'm getting into my mother's car at 10 o'clock. Lovely experience. They'd put the antiseptic on it. They'd stitch me up, and then they put the little glue on top of it so that it was sealed from, you know, any stuff. And it's healed up nicely. It's been a few days. It's not even really sore. They gave me pain med prescription. I didn't have to take any of it. I just had Tylenol. This was none of those things. This was somebody with probably a sharp rock. There's no anesthesia. There's no Tylenol. Probably not even washing the hands or the rock from one guy to the next. All right? Line it up. Off it goes. Next guy on the line. You ever have something get infected? It starts to get inflamed, and then it's red, and then it's pussy, and then it's sore, and you can't even touch it. You remember you saw Gladiator with the guy with a wound and the flies are in it, the maggots are eating at it. It came to pass on the third day when they were sore. And there was no turpinhydrate. There was no Tylenol. There was no OxyContin. There was nothing. There were two of the sons of Jacob, Simeon and Levi, Dinah's brethren. These were her full, because remember, there's like four moms in this Mary family. These were her full brother and sisters, full brothers. Two of them, Simeon and Levi, took each man his sword, and they came upon the city boldly, which means shamelessly, sinfully, and they slew all of them. I mean, you know these guys are hurting. When two guys can walk in with a sword and take out a city, all these guys are just completely useless. They're in so much pain. So they trick them into getting circumcised, and then when they are helpless, they walk in. They killed every male. They slew Hamor and Shechem and his sons with the edge of the sword. They took Dinah out of Shechem's house because she was there, apparently. The sons of Jacob came upon the slain, and they spoiled the city because they had defiled their sister. They took their sheep and their oxen and their donkeys and that which was in the city and that which was in the field, and all their wealth and all their little ones and their wives took they captive, and they spoiled all that was in the house. Let's kill all the males. Let's take the women and children as slaves. Let's steal all of their stuff because we are Israel, God's chosen people. And see, there's an important lesson from this, okay? Just because it's written in the Bible does not mean A, God told them to do it, or B, it was right. It's just telling you what happened. And then look at spiritual dad. Jacob says to Simeon and Levi, "You have troubled me to make me stink among the inhabitants of the land, and the Canaanites and the Perizzites, and I, being few in number, they shall gather themselves together against me and slay me, and I shall be destroyed. I, he's got an eye problem. I, me. He doesn't care about the fact that his boys just murdered a whole city and took into slavery a bunch of women and children and stole a bunch of stuff. He's afraid it'll come back on him. Notice he's not named Israel in this particular passage. And they said to Dad, should he deal with our sister as with a harlot? Dad is not going to say or do anything about this until his deathbed in chapter 49, which is really unfortunate. If, you know, and we'll end right there on that happy note. But again, if God has enough grace to be able to forgive and cover people like this, I'm pretty sure there's nobody in the room that's murdered a whole city and taken a bunch of people as slaves and stole from them. God forgave them. He can forgive you. There is grace available. None of this stuff is right. You know, what is it they say? That history's like an onion. The more layers you peel back, the more you find, and each one makes you cry. Let's pray. Lord, thank you so much that our history can be forgiven. Lord, that our sins, though they're scarlet, they can be as wool. We can be white as snow. Lord, help us to learn from the mistakes of those who have gone before us. Lord, help us to be men and women who do what's right, who are obedient in the first pass. Lord, help us to be men who lead our family in a godly way, women who raise our children to be godly sons and daughters. And Lord, forgive us. Give us grace. Help us to be Israel and not Jacob. We ask in Jesus' name. Amen. Grace and peace, guys.